This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. How are you doing today, Layla?
Okay. Happy New Year. How are you, Dr. Hoffman?
Yes, a belated Happy New Year. And some of us probably, it's already to the point where some people are foundering on their New Year's resolutions.
it took a matter of days. I'm just thinking already, for those who had resolutions to get healthier, join a gym, exercise regularly, the gyms get really crowded in January.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they start to thin out by February.
Yep. I saw a lot of zealous people working out in my gym.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, over the holiday time, I had a little more time to work on stuff and work out. And I have to say, I pulled off a little bit of a coup this year because I managed this year both on Christmas Day and on New Year's Day. It's like a double coup to do an outside run. You know, outside runs, piece of cake in you know, June, July. This time of year, because of the weather, it's kind of iffy, but the weather was nice in the 40s both days, and I managed to get glorious outdoor runs to commemorate Christmas Day and New Year's Day 2017. So, feeling good and trying to do a little more yoga because I think that's going to hopefully balance out my training program. It's no use being able to do marvelous fits of endurance and have your body racked in pain and, you know, beset with stiffness. So that's, that's been part of my goal this New Year's. Also, I got a new book. And let me just get it. It's over here on the other side of the desk. Hold on one second. Mm-hmm. It's called... This book is a doorstop. It's a big, heavy book. It's called It's called The Food Lab by J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. And it's a book that I've been meaning to buy. I saw it was, you know, slightly discounted. It costs like, I think, like $49 or $45. And they had a little special on it. It was like $35. So I got the book and with the goal of improving my cooking. Now, I really like to cook and prepare foods. But I've always thought that my cooking was a little bit haphazard. You know, especially I'll look at a recipe and I'll go, you know, I can short-circuit this recipe. I don't have these ingredients. I can substitute this, that, or the other thing. And usually it comes out fine. But then for some inexplicable reason, you know, it may come out horrible. It's just not clear why.
Oh, yeah.
And this book is actually written by an MIT engineer, genius, physicist type, who decided instead of becoming a professor, he was going to become a professor of biology. But then he said, you know, biological research is so slow. It's not really connected to real life issues. He decided to go into culinary arts, got some jobs in restaurants. And then he applied his physics and chemistry knowledge to food. And so this book is about various principles in cooking.
Kind of like an Alton Brown on the Food Network or somebody.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah. And so I'm hoping to pore over this book. I'll write a review of it for our listeners and use it to improve, you know, make my cooking a little bit more scientifically oriented. You know, simple things like, should you char a steak or a burger first? I mean, that's the dogma, right? Is that you put a char on the outside, then you cook slowly. No, it turns out the opposite works better in terms of preserving the juices. The best steakhouses and restaurants are now, they even sometimes take the steak and put it in a flavor pouch in like, and parboil it. Horror of horrors. And then they get the inside a little bit done, and then they throw it on the grill at very high temperature, put some char on the outside. So hopefully these little techniques will make my cooking a little more refined, a little more based on rational principles, because a lot of what I do is kind of like slapdash and intuitive, and it's based on no rational principles. Cooking is a science, actually, and I've treated it like just something to do, trial and error.
Got to eat.
Yeah.
Slapdash.
Right.
Right.
And especially, you know, doing a lot of these recipes where, it calls for dairy. Okay, well, what are you going to substitute for dairy? What's going to give it the same qualities? Oh, you're supposed to thicken the gravy with flour. Okay, can't do that, because we're on a grain-free, gluten-free, So I'm going that's one of my resolutions for 20. It's like a modest resolution for 2017.
You don't need many.
Right. So, do you have any special resolutions for 2017 for yourself?
I don't make resolutions. I
smart.
I'm an eternal optimist.
Okay.
There are lots of things, on our plate life-wise and everything, mm-hmm. and now being property owners and tackling the objective of building a house and
you're now landed
all
gentry,
this other kind of
landed
thing.
Gentry like the yeah. Russian aristocracy. Do you have serfs on your property? Is it you work in the fields?
We'll be working in the fields, yes, growing vegetables. We're actually really looking forward to, growing our own produce and stuff.
That's going to be great.
I've already picked out the fruit trees I'd like to have in the front yard and then what will grow in the backyard. My husband has an enormous green thumb, has had his own greenhouse, and mm-hmm. so we're really well paired this way in terms of, the food we want to grow.
How strange that your husband is a contractor. And don't live in a house you don't live in a, your own home. Finally, that's a dream that you can realize. That sounds good.
Exactly. Well, he's been busy doing other things. So.
Building other people's houses.
Building other people's houses. Doing other people's kitchen remodels, right?
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Something to look forward to in 2017. All right. Let's get to questions. Questions can come to us via a radio program at AOL.com, and we'll be endeavoring to answer your questions throughout 2017. So what do we have in the mailbag?
We've got an email from Delilah. Oh, and speaking about the aches and pains, Dr. Hoffman, that you were just talking about, she's asking, which is better, Tylenol or ibuprofen? Which do you prefer? Now, one's an NSAID and one is not.
Right. So the answer is they both have considerable drawbacks. And so therefore, it is really desirable if you find yourself reaching for these things on a more than occasional basis that you investigate ways of addressing the pain in a more natural way. For me, it's been an aggressive program of diet modification, cleaning up my diet, reducing my intake of inflammatory foods, because after all, I am 64, so things come up. And also now a program of yoga and stretching, which will, take care of some of those tight areas that, put you into pain. Now, unfortunately, some people are very far gone in terms of the potential for pain. They have bone spurs. They have no synovial membrane left in their knees and hips. They've got serious spasm issues. By the way, in terms of spasm, magnesium is wonderful for spasm. Omega-3 fatty acids are excellent in terms of inflammation. Curcumin as well, boswellin. We use a hops extract called Caprex, which has anti-inflammatory effects. It's also sort of a natural non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. Works in a slow, gradual fashion as opposed to rapid fashion like ibuprofen. But coming back to the question, the downsides of Tylenol. Well, Tylenol is hepatotoxic. We know that. And that people can actually get into trouble with fairly low doses of Tylenol that affect the liver, especially if they're sick and they take, more than, the recommended dose. But even the recommended dose is 6 Tylenols a day. that's the max you should take. But if you're sick, and especially if you've got some liver weakness or you've consumed alcohol, and some of these medications actually contain alcohol, you know, some of the cough medications and cold and flu remedies. So, you know, you're not eating, you're depleting glutathione. That's precisely what Tylenol does. It depletes glutathione. And it does so to the point where you can actually develop liver failure. So whenever, you know, I've had to take Tylenol-based medication when I broke my leg. Obviously, there was Tylenol with, you know, some kind of synthetic opiate, codeine, you know.
Tylenol-3.
Right, right. And I always took N-acetylcysteine to offset the effects of the Tylenol to help rebuild the glutathione that it was depleting. There's also some studies that suggest that people are psychologically numbed when they take Tylenol. They lose empathy. You know, it's almost like, I feel your pain. Well, if you're not feeling pain, your own pain, you may not feel other people's pain. So you become less empathic. And that could be why we have... you know, a crueler, you know, more self-involved, less compassionate societies, that the vast majority of us are taking pain medications. And so we have no ability to empathize with people. That actually has come up in studies. There's also some studies that suggest that Tylenol may increase the risk for autism. In the offspring of women who take Tylenol during pregnancy. So
in
that's
pregnancy,
not good.
Yeah.
And that may be because it affects the detoxification systems via depletion of glutathione. So there's some downsides to Tylenol. Now, also, it's very individual. Some people are Tylenol responders, and some people are ibuprofen responders, and different types of pain respond to different types of medications. For me, when I develop a certain type of muscle soreness, and I have to say, maybe in 2016, I had to do this like 1 or 2 days. You know, Tylenol does the trick, and I know it works for me. And in fact, when I take ibuprofen, I'm immediately intolerant to it because it causes me some heartburn. And it does strip the gastrointestinal lining. It can cause ulcers. It can cause gastritis. It's a major cause of gastrointestinal bleeding in this country, you know, sending tens of thousands of people to the hospital, some of whom require blood transfusion, some of whom perhaps will die as a result of taking these medications that literally create ulcerative craters in their stomachs. But short of that, you know, even if you don't have a frank ulcer or bleeding, you can get microscopic bleeding, or you can develop leaky gut syndrome. It does irritate the intestinal wall. It increases the risk for ulcerative colitis and perhaps Crohn's disease, but certainly ulcerative colitis. And the other thing about ibuprofen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, is they may increase the risk for heart attacks and strokes because, paradoxically, while they may increase gastrointestinal bleeding, they may thicken the blood. And so that's not good. And then...
And they can be hard on the kidneys as well with long-term use.
Exactly what I was about to say is that, you know, I actually had a patient, a very unfortunate woman. She was a woman in her perhaps late 60s, early 70s. Who came to me because she was on dialysis and she wanted help with support during dialysis. And I asked her, gee, what was, you know, did you have diabetes? Did you have hypertension? Usually those are the major risk factors for dialysis. And she said, no. I said, well, how did you end up with kidney failure? And she said, I just took too much ibuprofen. I said, well, how many did you take? She said, I took about six a day for about 10 or 15 years because I was in pain. Doctor said, fine, no problem. You know, she had arthritis. And her kidneys failed.
Here's another true story for you.
We'll raise blood pressure, too. We'll raise blood pressure, too. Yeah.
A personal friend of mine who has bone-on-bone knee osteoarthritis was told by his doctor, oh, just take, you know, ibuprofen every day. And he was taking about six, maybe eight a day. And after a couple of months, he fainted. He had anemia. He had an ulcer.
Yeah.
Wound up in the hospital.
Wow.
Very, very frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Frightening.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, one of my first GI bleeds, I remember that night like it was today because I had five patients admitted to the hospital that night. It was the 4th of July of 1983, I think it was. And I had just started because, you know, doctors start on July 1st. So on the 4th of July, here I was just out of med school, neophyte doctor. I had 5 admissions at the Manhattan VA Hospital. And one of them was a big, big African-American gentleman, really strong and robust. It looked like this guy could pick up a refrigerator and toss it across the room. But he came in with a quarter of his blood supply. And I asked what happened. His wife told me that he'd fainted in church. He'd been having some aches and pains, and he was taking Advil. And the result was he developed a major gastrointestinal bleed. So I spent half the night suctioning blood out. You know, I'd never put an NG tube into a patient, nasogastric tube into a patient, but I literally pulled out quarts and quarts of blood from his stomach after a severe gastrointestinal bleed. They saved him with blood transfusions, but a horrible thing happened. He developed a hepatitis C from the transfusions, because in those days they had no way of screening blood. So you could see it was a calamitous situation for this very robust, middle-aged African-American man who, at the end of a hospitalization, had lost, you know, 60 pounds, was weak as a kitten, and, you know, turned yellow because of hepatitis. It was a train wreck.
Wow.
All due to excessive Advil use. I mean, cautionary tale. Not everybody's going to have this, but got to be careful.
Just because it's over the counter doesn't mean we can take it willy-nilly or anything like that. So yeah.
Pain is a big problem in this country. We need more natural ways of addressing pain because, you know, it's easy to go to the, you know, the counter in a supermarket or drugstore and stock up on these medications. In fact, they encourage you to do it. You look at ads on TV and they say, oh, you know, you're picking up your kid. That would be a person in their 30s or 40s, and you're sore, and so just take some medication. Or, you know, you're a mailman, and you know you're having trouble lifting some boxes. Just just take Advil every day, or just take Tylenol. Mm. Not the solution.
Right. Wow, Delilah. We hope this answers your question. Anyway, so please moderate discerning use of either product and always take it on a full stomach if you must.
And again, the proper use of these products is like, you got something really bad, you know, take it for a couple of days. Okay. I mean, and I want you to be in pain. But, the use of it chronically is really problematic.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Delilah, for your question. We've got an email from Michael. It's about a recent podcast you did, Dr. Hoffman. He writes, greetings, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Do you agree with Dr. Josh Middledorf's critique of the alleged importance of antioxidants? I thought that the evidence was huge that support the benefits of a diet high in antioxidants. You didn't seem to rebut his statement, perhaps because you are too kind and courteous or because he was a guest on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to your comments.
Well, you know, reflecting on that comment, you know, I am nearly perfect, but one of my flaws that I really have to work on in 2017 is I'm too nice, and I'm gonna work on that one. Look, I defer to my guests because it's a forum for them to get their opinions across, and sometimes I gently, you know, push back on them and say, well, you know, many think that such and such. I try to frame it in such a way that it's not debate forum. And I know that in this day and age of, you know, cable TV where everything is a setup, everything is debate, you know, you get one side versus another. And it's sort of like, it's sort of like a throwback to the Colosseum, you know, like the Christians versus the lions, the gladiators, gladiators combat. We watch it on TV now. That's not the way I conduct intelligent medicine podcasts. But I have to say that so let me explain where he was coming from. And one of the reasons I didn't push back aggressively is because he has a point. And I have to acknowledge this. And I think one of the best facets of a flexible intellect is that one can integrate new concepts without going to pieces. And, you know, for so long, we've looked at free radicals as the cause of aging and disease. And so we've come up with a raft of antioxidants, which combat these free radicals in a kind of a simplistic way. You know, these are going to help to quench the fires in the body and prevent these little free radicals from ricocheting around and damaging our cell membranes and, you know, hurting our cells. So the counter theory has arisen because there are some studies, frankly, that show that antioxidants are not that effective in some settings. Most classic study was using beta-carotene in the treatment of Finnish smokers, actually backfired. They had an increased risk of lung cancer as opposed to decreased risk. Okay, you could argue against that study by saying, well, very high-risk population. You give a highly refined, very narrow-spectrum beta-carotene as opposed to, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables with, you know, wide spectrum of natural carotenoids. And, you know, you may have a backfire. You may actually, some theorize that when you take an antioxidant and you put it into a highly oxidative system, it can turn into a pro-oxidant. So there's technical flaws with some of those studies. But there are some studies that suggest that there's sort of a yin-yang with the body where you do get some revving up of the body's oxidative defense in the face of free radicals. So, in other words, you can induce endogenous antioxidant systems like glutathione and superoxide dismutase when challenged. But if you don't challenge the system, if you constantly blanket the system with antioxidants, maybe, just maybe, your own internal antioxidant defenses will get flabby and weak and won't, you know,
it's
be
almost,
there for
it's
you.
It's almost like a little bit of hormesis.
Yeah, beautiful word, yes.
Yeah.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, for me, in that you're presenting the body with a challenge to rev up and come out and fight. That's really that really is the core of that. Interestingly, Dr. Hoffman, I got a similar question, which I answered recently on one of my podcasts on Layla Weighs In, which listeners can listen to. It's up every week about your podcast with Dr. Middeldorf and what I thought about it. And I did express that, you know, the Intelligent Medicine Podcast is a platform for many different points of view from other experts. And everything is worthy of critical review, of scrutiny, of thoughtful mulling over, all of the above, and to consider everything. That's what good science does.
And the other point to be made is that this is a field that, you know, the field of nutrition is a field that's rife with controversy. And, you know, from the very fundamental question of, you know, what's the best diet? I mean, that is extremely controversial. Then, you know, what are the best supplements? Are antioxidants, and one of the controversies is, are antioxidants beneficial? Or are they a waste of time? Or worse yet, could they be harmful? And so, you know, I've opened myself up to the perspective to be selective about antioxidant supplementation in some cases. However, I got to say that it didn't change my own personal approach to taking supplements. I take vitamin E at 800 international units per day. I take alpha-lipoic acid, which is an antioxidant. I take vitamin C. I take a mixed a multivitamin, which contains, you know, a smattering of all the antioxidants. It may be, though, that the best antioxidants are ones that you obtain from food, you know, still, because, you know, you're going to get, you know, a wide spectrum of antioxidants from food that you wouldn't ordinarily get. I apologize. I apologize in the background. You're going to hear some pounding. And there's, because you hear it now. And that's because they put up a sign in my apartment building. I mean, my studio is in my apartment, saying that we apologize to our neighbors. We're going to be doing some renovation. These are my neighbors in this building here. So so you may be hearing some interesting noises from time to time here.
And for those antioxidants that you just mentioned, Dr. Hoffman, I also talked about on my podcast. And I did go over, for anybody who's interested, I did go over all the food sources.
Right.
For all of those particular antioxidants as well, I believe supplementation is important. I take those supplements myself, but we eat first. So it's important to have a good diet. Have a good diet.
Right.
And have your supplements also be adjunctive to that. So,
Okay.
Okay.
So this
Michael,
is a good point at which
to question.
This is a good point at which to pause, and then I'm going to go, you know, yell at the workman and tell him to just knock it up. No, I don't think I can. But when we return, What questions can we anticipate? Give us a preview.
I eat a quarter pound of garlic a day. Is that dangerous? Is that too much?
That's not you, Layla. That's
wow.
A listener, right?
Yeah.
That's from a listener. Okay. We'll answer that question in just a moment. When we return, I think I'm going to take some aspirin because I've gotten a headache from this pounding. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Stay tuned for part two, our weekly Q&A with Layla.